From the studios of News Talk Radio 580 CFRA, it's Sunday House Call with Dr. Barry Dworkin. If you have a medical question, call us at 521-TALK. That's 521-8255. Email sundayhousecall@cfra.com. Now here's Dr. Barry Dworkin.
Good afternoon and welcome. After a three-month hiatus, welcome back to edition number 292 of Sunday House Call. I'm Dr. Barry Dworkin, and we're taking your calls at 521-TALK, 521-8255, or 1-800-580-2372. We're broadcasting live at 580 CFRA, News Talk Radio 580 CFRA. And as always, as you remembered, it's always better to call in early rather than wait towards the end of the show. We only have 1 hour to answer your questions, and I have a few topics I'd like to bring up. I have about 3 months' worth of pent-up catharsis to let go today, so I really would like to get your opinions on a few things and also your questions. 521-TALK, 521-8255, 1-800-580-2372. Any medical questions you may have, please feel free to call in. I have been reading a few columns, and one of them is by Ottawa Citizen journalist Dan Gardner, and is one from yesterday, Saturday Citizen, in the argument section of Section B of the Ottawa Citizen, was called Not Lovin' Olympic Junk Food Peddlers. And in this case, it had to do with Olympic athletes that are shilling themselves for the various junk foods, McDonald's being a particular brand out there that is being used quite a bit. And he takes one person to task. In this case, it was Cindy Klassen, but there are others that are in his line of sight. In fact, on his blog, Citizen Katzenjammer, today, there is a picture of Alexandre Bilodeau, a gold medal winner, who just several hours after winning his gold medal goes to McDonald's to buy his Big Mac, a nice prominent picture of the Big Mac, his fries, and Coca-Cola sitting on this tray on the counter. He's holding the tray along with two servers who are all smiling and pining for the camera. And 2 hours after, he wins a gold medal. Now, I don't know about you, but I would think that it wouldn't be the first or even second thing on my mind after winning a gold medal at the Olympics to head over to my local McDonald's to pose for a picture while I buy my Big Mac. That's just me, but I'm not sure that that would come into the mind of many people unless they were being paid a nice sum of money to do that. And so this goes to what Dan Gardner is saying in his article yesterday. And he says that Olympic athletes are the living embodiment of exercise, athleticism, and vigorous health. When everyone watches, everyone gets the message. Best of all, kids get the message. When somebody like Cindy Klassen wins gold, everybody cheers and the kids look up to them. The conclusion is obvious. Give athletes the money they need to own the podium and become role models and watch the country get skinny as a bear coming out of hibernation. So what he goes on further to say is that although you have governments that are trying to promote health through education, through activities, even through our taxes to be able to deduct certain expenses for your children to be active, on the other hand, you then have corporations that are promoting products that really, when you think about it, are not in the best interests of overall general health. And so what he says, to sum up, governments give public money to the Olympics in part to encourage healthy lifestyles. And this money helps make the Olympics a brand so powerful that McDonald's and Coca-Cola pay to associate themselves with it in order to strengthen their own brands and improve sales of junk that contributes to the spiraling rates of obesity and obesity-related diseases, which governments are fighting by spending large and growing amounts of money on, among other things, the Olympics. So it goes around in a nice little circle. And in McDonald's right now, as he states, there is a large display of children's toys based on the official mascots of the Vancouver Games. These are figure skaters, goalies, ski jumpers, and there's even one with a couple of mascots, Miga and Quachi, in a bobsleigh. And he says, it's adorable, but I have to bend over to look because the display is at the eye level of young children who can be counted on to bug their parents for high-calorie, sodium-saturated, fat-laden Happy Meal so they can play with Miga and Quachi. Is this what we really want our Olympic athletes to be doing? And that's a question I'm putting out to you today. Is, are you bothered by the advertisements of Olympic athletes, especially those that are winning gold medals, to then shill for companies who produce foods that in the long run are not very healthy for us and are sending sort of the wrong message? So that's one of the things that I thought was very interesting. And you can find that article in the Citizen, yesterday's Citizen, and it's called Not Loving Olympic Junk Food Peddlers by Dan Gardner. 1-800-580-2372 is the number to call. 521-TALK, 521-8255. We have no callers yet, and I would certainly like to hear from you. As I have said before, I can certainly discuss things for the entire hour, but I really don't like to hear myself talk. I'd rather be speaking with you and answering your questions. So if you would call 521-8255, 521-CFRA, or 1-800-580-2372, is the number to call, 521-8255. And next week, I am going to be having on the air with me Dr. Yoni Friedhoff. As you know, I've had Dr. Friedhoff on here many times, and this is to review what Health Canada is planning to do, and a lot of people are not aware of this. Health Canada is trying to push ahead to change the rules to allow virtually any food to be fortified. That is your junk foods, your restaurants, any places can end up fortifying foods with all kinds of vitamins and minerals. Now, when you think about it, there are over 50,000 food products on our shelves, and there is a set of standards that serve as sort of a global nutritional frame of reference and code of practice. It's called the Codex from the World Health Organization and the United Nations. And what it essentially says is that if you're going to be putting something into a food, you have to demonstrate, and manufacturers have to demonstrate, that there is a public need for it. Not just a matter of a want, but there has to be a need for putting this in there. And so they want to change the rules and have it so that if there's demand for it, it gets put in. And we can get into some of the problems with that next week with Dr. Friedhoff, when if you're consuming all kinds of foods and you end up with too much of a particular vitamin or a mineral that you're taking in, that could actually potentially cause some health problems. So Dr. Friedhoff will be in here next week answering your questions as well. And we're going to take a small break. We have Jerry from Orleans, who has a comment on the athletes and the advertising therein. I'm Dr. Barry Dworkin. You're listening to Sunday House Call, and we'll be back in just a couple of minutes.
580 CFRA Sunday House Call, your weekly checkup with Dr. Barry Dworkin. Call us at 521-TALK, 521-8255, or email the doctor, sundayhousecall@cfra.com. Now back to Dr. Barry Dworkin on 580 CFRA Sunday House Call. The numbers, 521-TALK, 521-8255.
And we are back, and we're going to go straight to the phone lines, and welcome to Jerry in Orleans. Good afternoon.
Hi, good afternoon, Dr. Dworkin.
How are you?
Good, thanks. I just wanted to say, welcome back to the airwaves.
Well, thank you. I also should say that actually express my heartfelt appreciation to everyone who wrote in after the show was put on hiatus, expressing their desire to hear the show again, and that made a huge difference. So that big thank you goes out to all the listeners.
We're glad to have you back. I think that the whole Sunday programming idea that they were running with needs some hardcore revisions anyway. I listen to CFRA 24/7 pretty much.
Right.
And rerun Sunday, as I call it. I'm glad to see that it's kind of
not
so heavy on the rerun side.
Right.
Now,
well, we're live now, so this is the good thing.
That's fabulous. Absolutely. I just wanted to touch base on the topic you raised with respect to the athletes.
And, yes.
For most people understand that, these are amateur athletes. They need to train numerous hours per day.
Mm-hmm.
They don't have, what one would call traditional sort of full-time jobs, because you can't train 14 hours a day, plus work 8 hours a day and sleep.
Right.
So, they don't have, you know, they have what I would consider probably part-time jobs for the most part to allow them to have a training regime that keeps them at the you know, the level that they're at.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not surprised at all that, you know, corporations have stepped in basically to, you know, to provide funding and backing, you know, economic backing for these athletes. You know, when governments are, you know, looking to save money or not put forward the level of cash that's really required to allow them to actually really compete, you know? I mean, the guy goes to McDonald's and gets a Big Mac and a Coke and a fry, you know, big deal. You know, he's sponsored by McDonald's because the governments fall short.
Well, I agree with you, Jerry, that on the aspect of they're not obviously swimming in cash. A lot of the athletes, as you mentioned, do have that particular background. My question, though, is that if they are, you know, their exercise regimen and their diets are very well controlled, right, because they have to perform, and that the athlete also can choose what corporation is going to sponsor them. So does it have to be McDonald's, where the image is somebody who is, in this case with Alexandre Bilodeau, it was obviously a staged thing, you know, to go a couple of hours after you winning the gold medal. It's like when Patrick Roy and the Canadians won the Stanley Cup. It was 1993 or 86, I forget which one it was. But while he was holding the cup, he looked at the camera and said, "I'm going to Disney World."
Yeah, that was the same as the World Series. The guy did the same thing.
Exactly, exactly. I mean, so yes, and you know what? If someone can earn some money from this, that's one thing. It's where they decide to do it.
No, I think the question runs deeper than that. I'm not disagreeing with anything you're saying.
Right.
I think that you have to look at the reason why they're doing it.
Well, I know that the government with the Own the Podium program contributed $66 million to it.
Yeah, but they've only contributed the money,
right,
to sports where they thought,
mm-hmm,
through some kind of mathematical calculation or whatever,
right,
that they had a chance. So if you and I were just decent athletes and could make it to the Olympics in whatever category we're in,
right,
but didn't really have a shot at a medal, well, you know what? Too bad.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think, to me, it's more a philosophical issue in terms of what the responsibility is of the athlete with regards to where they want that money to come from. Because, as I said, you can shill for McDonald's and Coca-Cola, and that's their right to do that. But if they are supposed to embody discipline, health, honor, respect, integrity, what does it say then to people, or to children especially, who want to emulate, or at least, you know, who participate in sports, and what an Olympic athlete, a gold medal Olympic athlete, embodies in our sort of our vision of what it's supposed to represent. And then you have them do this. You know, it's one thing, you know, I used, for example, they say, you know, I've used Nike runners. Okay, it's part of your sport. It helped you. Fantastic. You want to do that? That's your business. You're not really, you know, that sort of goes in line with your territory of being an athlete and working out.
I mean, you would almost expect it, right?
Yeah, but to go to McDonald's after you win a gold medal and to pose with a, right, Big Mac and the picture is there, you can see the picture on the internet.
Oh, you know what? I think that picture probably is more valuable to McDonald's.
Absolutely.
Than any amount of money that they threw behind that athlete at the time, right?
Absolutely. But to me, that is... It sullies the whole concept of what an Olympic,
right,
athlete is supposed to
be. I mean,
be.
In the same breath, though, I don't know if you saw it, but at the time of that, the Phelps swimmer guy?
Yes.
They had a pretty decent documentary on about what that guy's day was like. And if you saw how much food,
right,
that guy eats.
Oh, yeah.
Like, hello?
But
no one on earth eats like that.
Oh, you see those Tour de France cyclists consuming 8,000 calories of food a day. So,
this guy was having like 14,000 calories in a sitting. He'd go to a buffet and like, because he had to.
Right. But for the most part, their training regimen and the foods that they eat, especially when they are training and they are working out, they are very careful about the foods that they're eating.
Absolutely.
So in this case, the association is... I won my gold medal. I'm going for my Big Mac and my Coke and my fries. And there's a disconnect,
right,
there to me.
I think if the government, you know, ponied up a little bit more money and made that situation a little harder to happen, it simply wouldn't happen. And I mean, it could come even from the health department.
Right. But
you know what I mean?
But at the same time, Jerry, I would have to say that, yes, your point is well taken with regards to funding of the training, but it's still, isn't the onus still on a person to say, you know, this may, even though there's money there, that it's still not the right thing for me to be doing in terms of the image I wish to portray.
But saying, you know, what are you going to do now? I'm going to have a salad. Just doesn't like.
Well, of course. But you know what? He likely was not even hungry. Let's face this. Okay, this is an hour or two. You think about it. You win something. Okay, and it's a big deal to you. Is the first
the
thing in your
deal
mind?
Of your life,
yeah.
Probably.
Is the first or second thought in your mind? I'm heading to McDonald's to get a Big Mac, a Coke, and a fries.
You and I both know the answer is absolutely not.
Right. So that's sort of the thing that bugs me, is that it really is a bit of a sellout, and it's not really, to me, a very honorable thing to have done. I'm looking at it from that aspect. You know, he's within his rights to do whatever he wants, and I'm not disagreeing with you in any way with regards to, you know, what the athletes are doing in terms of earning some money. But it's there's different ways of earning money. And to me, this is not really appropriate if the guy is an athlete, an elite athlete, and is trying to demonstrate proper health and nutrition that should go along with that.
Agreed. Well, let's hope that the sponsors change and, funding's made more available, and maybe the next set of athletes won't make those types of choices. Right. I mean,
well, I agree, and thanks a lot for calling, Jerry.
Oh, you're quite welcome.
All right.
Great show. Thanks.
Thanks. Bye-bye. Bye. 1-800-580-2372 is the number to call. 521-TALK, 521-8255. We only have one line available, and we're going to go to line two and speak to Suzanne in Ottawa. Good afternoon. Suzanne, are you there?
Oh, yes, I'm here.
Hi.
Thanks for making yourself available.
Oh, my pleasure.
I have an infected finger,
mm-hmm.
and it's on my right hand, and it's the finger beside the little finger,
mm-hmm.
and it's around the nail, and I haven't got any cuticle around that nail,
mm-hmm.
and so for about a year and a half, it would become inflamed just around the edge.
Right.
Then lately, it really flared up
mm-hmm.
so badly that I had to get antibiotics.
Right. And this is just the fingertip, right around the nail.
You know, right around the nail.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What you're describing is something called a paronychia, right? That's the fancy term for it, which simply means an infection around the nail bed or along the edge of the nail.
Yeah.
Typically, it happens because the cuticle either is damaged or there's been some injury that leads to bacteria getting in under the skin in that area and causing some inflammation. It is a very straightforward infection to treat. And in fact, oral antibiotics are not recommended for something like this because they don't work very well for an infected finger. What works very well is, and in fact, what works very well is putting that fingertip in very hot water, not to the point that it scalds you, but extremely hot water. The reason is that the heat itself is powerful enough to destroy the bacteria because bacteria can't live at that temperature. And if you soak the finger, it doesn't have to be salt water. If you soak the finger for 20 minutes in very hot water, you make sure that water still stays hot, almost to the point that you can, you know, that you can stand it, and it just gets a little bit less you know, you're just finding it tolerating it not too well. Just below that level, you soak that for 20 minutes, three times a day for about 2 days. And it usually tends to resolve in one way or the other. Now, we're going to take a small break. Suzanne and I can just fill you in a bit more on what else to do, but we have to take a small break.
Thank you.
And we'll be back in just a couple of minutes. Take a break for the news. You are listening to Sunday House Call on 580 CFRA. I'm Dr. Barry Dworkin. Back with your calls in just a couple of minutes.
Dr. Barry Dworkin, Sunday House Call, News Talk Radio 580 CFRA. Now back to Dr. Barry Dworkin on 580 CFRA Sunday House Call. The numbers 521-TALK, 521-8255.
And we're going to go right back and complete our conversation with Suzanne. So Suzanne, the infected finger, as I said, is called a paronychia.
And I wanted to write.
Right.
Paronychia.
It's P-A-R-A, P-A-R-O.
R O
N Y C H I A.
Like glad you spelled it. Thank you. And that's very helpful information.
Yeah, it's a type of infection that usually stays local around the fingernail. If there is a suspicion of spread of the infection, what you usually will see is a red streak that starts to head down the finger towards the back of the hand, and that usually will indicate a spread of an infection between the tissue layers. It doesn't happen that often. Usually what will happen with a paronychia is that it will swell up, and when you do the in this case, soaking it in hot water, one of two things is going to happen after a couple of days. If you do this for 20 minutes three times a day, is that it either will completely disappear or resolve and start to shrink away, or you'll end up with a small fluid-filled collection or a small abscess. Either one is what you're looking for. With a small abscess or the fluid is filled in there, I would see your physician to have that then drained. You don't want to start putting needles or cutting through the skin without an appropriate means of disinfecting the area, and that usually will help resolve it as well. But an oral antibiotic is not recommended for that type of infection. It doesn't, because it's a fingertip, the blood flow to the fingertip is compromised to some degree with the inflammation.
Yes.
And so as a result, if you take an antibiotic by mouth, not very much of it is going to get to that fingertip. And so it doesn't really work that well.
Yeah.
There are, with the hot soaks of the finger, there are topical antibiotic preparations that can penetrate through the skin and treat that way as well to help alleviate it. But I find that just the hot soaks work very well because, again, if the intention is to destroy the bacteria, the heat itself, because you're putting your finger into something that's very hot, the bacteria die. They just can't live at that temperature.
Yeah, that
so that
makes
works
sense.
That works just the best.
Yeah, that's just excellent. I'm happy to have it explained so well.
Well, you're very welcome, Suzanne, and I hope it heals up.
Well, me too. Now, is it possible that if I've been at a high-altitude skiing for the past week, now, would that have agitated it?
It shouldn't have, no. I mean, the only thing that could potentially have done that is just by wearing gloves and the fingers got wet or are very hot and humid and the skin itself got a bit soft. That can sometimes do that as well.
Okay. Thank you so much. I feel much better.
Oh, you're very welcome.
Thanks.
Bye-bye now.
Bye.
And we're going to line three and Marie in Ottawa. Good afternoon.
Hi, Dr. Dworkin.
How are you?
Fine, thank you. Okay, I really love your show.
Thanks.
So glad you're back. I prayed to God that you get back on.
And
you were so terrific on the Canada AM about a month and a half ago.
Oh, thanks. Thanks.
I saw you, and I thought you were better than Dr. Oz.
you were
just perfect there.
Thanks.
You're welcome. Anyway, I just heard recently, though, about for women that low thyroid can cause ladies to gain weight, be discouraged, gain weight on their tummy, and that if it has to be, the reading coming back from the doctor should be 2 or under to have this ideal, otherwise this good thyroid function. Otherwise, you should take some medication. And a lot of women who are in their 40s and 50s have, these sort of same symptoms.
Mm-hmm.
They're gaining a little bit of weight and this and that. But anyway, can you tell us more about this low thyroid?
Yeah, hypothyroidism or low thyroid thyroid gland function happens, I believe, when you look at the rates, lifetime risk for women is about 1 in 6 women over their lifetimes may experience a low thyroid hormone function. Now, that being said, there is a range of normal for thyroid hormone. And when we measure thyroid function, there are 2 values that we look at. One of them is called a thyroid stimulating hormone, or TSH. This is a hormone that's produced in the pituitary gland of our brain that will get secreted and will stimulate the thyroid gland to produce thyroid hormone. The thyroid hormone is measured as a value called T4. That's just the test that's done. So you want to have, for example, a TSH, a normal TSH is anywhere between 0.35 to about 5. That's considered the normal range.
Okay.
And a T4 is usually normal between, I believe, 9 to 20. That's sort of the numbers that are given. So when measuring thyroid function, if those values are within those range intervals, then that's considered to be normal. Most people, when they start gaining weight after, say the mid-30s or 40s, That's happening not usually because of their thyroid. What tends to happen is the body's need for calories to function in its day-to-day function diminishes as we get older, but our food intake, even if it remains the same, becomes proportionally greater in terms of the net extra calories that we keep in. So people end up gaining, you know, half a pound a month, and they find out that within a year they've gained 5 or 10 pounds, and they look back and they go, I really haven't changed my eating habits. But it's not the eating habits per se, although that can play a role. It's rather that their body's need for calories in order to function in its day-to-day functioning diminishes over time and with each decade that a person lives. So if someone is noticing signs of hypothyroidism, the signs usually are more fatigue, skin changes, the skin gets thicker, it gets a bit more oily, people end up, in terms of bowel function, can get more constipated. Depression is another symptom, just feeling really wrung out. The hair can get coarser when you feel the hair, it just sort of changes, feels more coarse. Those are some of the things that you'll see, and weight gain as well. So those are some of the things that you'll see with a low functioning thyroid. The thyroid hormone is sort of literally almost like fuel for your body. It just speeds things up and it keeps things working in a normal way. Mm-hmm. And so when it tends to become less available, the body tends to slow down. And so hence you can gain weight with the same number of calories because it's slowing down your metabolism, so you're not using up as many calories during the day. But that being said, it's one of the things that you can check for very easily just by doing a blood test. But for most people that tend to gain weight in their 40s, it's usually not the thyroid gland. As much as I'd like to say it's thyroid and you can treat with thyroid hormone replacement, it's not usually what causes that weight gain. The most common causes are just the foods that we eat, calorie-dense foods, and the quantity that we consume every day.
Well, can it be from cortisol, from stress, from this cortisol?
That shouldn't influence thyroid function. So,
no, but weight gain, I mean?
Weight gain, not really from, if you have a normal functioning adrenal gland, which most people do, that's not going to contribute to the weight gain. Weight gain, for the most part, when you look at someone who's gaining weight, sure, you want to ask certain questions about hormone function and endocrine function as one of the reasons, and you do a workup just to make sure. But you also take a dietary history and you find out how many calories someone's consuming, what their basal rate should be, that is, how many calories for their height and weight should they be consuming, and how much more are they actually taking in? Are they exercising? And you likely will find that it doesn't take much. It takes literally, if someone is taking in 100 calories more a day than they should, and 100 calories is maybe a cookie or two or even a quarter of a sandwich. And if you're taking in 100 calories a day, you're going to gain 12 pounds in a year.
Really?
And so it doesn't take much, which is why weight creeps up on people. It's not that they gain weight 10 pounds in a month, but with the year that goes by, they look and they go, they step on the scale, and all of a sudden they're surprised that they're 10 pounds more, and they haven't really understood why. And that's usually why, because it's not as if they're gorging themselves every day, but they're taking in a little bit more than what they actually need, and their body stores it away bit by bit by bit, and it adds up. After 365 days of 100 calories more a day, that's 36,000 extra calories a year, which is 10 pounds.
I know. Well, Dr. Dworkin, I ate this muffin when I was out at a restaurant, and I opened the package, I ate it. Then after, I looked at the bottom, and the label said 450 calories.
Oh, yeah? Yeah.
I almost fainted.
It's very surprising. Well, Marie,
anyway,
thanks a lot for calling.
Okay, thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye now. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we have Paul in Ottawa, who wants to talk about media broadcasting accidents, I think in reference to the luge athlete who died and was broadcast on television. We have Mary in Ottawa, who's talking about claudication in the legs, and Tom in Ottawa Center, dry mouth in the morning. I'm Dr. Barry Dworkin. You're listening to Sunday House Call. Back with your calls in several minutes.
580 CFRA Sunday House Call, your weekly checkup with Dr. Barry Dworkin. Call us at 521-TALK, 521-8255, or email the doctor, sundayhousecall@cfra.com. Now back to Dr. Barry Dworkin on 580 CFRA Sunday House Call. The numbers, 521-TALK, 521-8255.
And straight back to the phone lines, and line 5, and Paul in Ottawa, good afternoon.
Hi, Dr. Barry. Last week, I was watching TV, and I'm sure just like a lot of people, they broadcasted the death of the Georgian luge athlete.
Mm-hmm.
And I was shocked by it. You know, there was the warning ahead of time saying, you know, be careful, these images might be disturbing. But to be honest with you, I was expecting to see sort of an aftermath from a distance, maybe some
mm-hmm.
people moving towards a body or something along those lines. But to actually see the, you know, the action, the death happen, left me quite shocked, quite moved. And right away, I was surprised that I saw that, because I've never seen that put on TV before, at least not on the mainstream news channels.
Right.
And I was just curious, is there a regulation, a limitation in broadcast about what you can show? Like, are they, I guess they're allowed to show that, but why haven't they showed that before? What made the difference between, deciding to broadcast this death, whereas in the past, we generally never saw these things?
Well, I think there are several reasons. One is that the technology today, in terms of where you can put cameras and how you can show things, has changed. You have had in the past sports accidents, car racing accidents that have been televised, cars burning, for example, and you see the driver in the car. So that has happened. But I think the way, especially for the Olympics, the way they have wired the track is that you now have cameras everywhere. And so you get that much more of a close-up as opposed to a car accident where you may be following the car, but it's still at a distance. I think this, as you rightly mentioned, was right up in front of you. And so you saw in literally graphic detail what happened to this this unfortunate individual. So there is a precedent. I mean, there are times where they do show these accidents. I think in this case, this was much more closer to home in that it was one person that was involved in an accident. Other times you see, for example, and you're right, you see things only after the fact, a train accident and you know, the survivors and lots of people being injured. But when it comes down to one person getting hurt, or in this case, dying from their injuries, there's a much more of a connection. You can identify with a single person more than you can, for the most part, than with 40, 50, 100, or 1,000 people getting hurt, because you're seeing that one person and identifying with what they may have felt.
Sure, but like I've seen even documentaries mm-hmm. done on traffic accidents, or one that comes to mind is pedestrian accidents.
Right.
And, you know, they were explaining that, you know, this person was killed for such and such a reason, and they just happen to have a surveillance video mm-hmm. from across the street or a traffic camera, wherever, yeah. and they would never show it. And it just seems that we've, you know, this was a sort of a step over that line. And where's the respect for the athlete? Where's the respect for his family? You know, like,
well, I happen to agree with you, Paul. The issue is, it's one thing if you see the accident. See, they were televising this, right? This was not.
But so, they repeated it on their newscast, and they
yes.
had it on their website. And it was very clear that they were
exactly.
choosing to show it.
Right. And I agree with you. That's on the one hand, you have the, you know, no one's expecting it to happen. So as you're watching, if you're watching it live, you saw that happen. But to repeat the broadcast or repeat it over and over again, I happen to agree with you, Paul, that imagine if it was one of our family members or loved ones that was in a horrific accident and they were playing this over and over again on television and going viral on YouTube, I certainly wouldn't feel very good about that.
Yeah.
So you're right. So it is, I don't think there's any rules against it, but where this comes down to is whether it is morally or ethically correct to do that, as opposed to whether it fulfills a guideline. And that's where people have been talking and debating this issue. You know, is this really news? Is this really something that people need to see again and again? Or is merely reporting the fact that, you know, on TV today, it was this unfortunate luge athlete suffered a grievous injury that resulted in his death. And isn't that enough for us? Why should we have to see this over or broadcast over and over again?
Yeah, I just think it's shameful on CTV's part to go for it. I personally, I think it's just, you know, gratuitous. You're literally, you know, trying to be sensational over
something. Yeah, I tend to agree with you, Paul. I don't think there was any need to show this repeatedly. It was broadcast. If it's broadcast, it gets onto YouTube, right? I mean, this kind of thing gets onto YouTube. And so it's going to be out there, but at the same time, you can choose not to see it. But when you're watching the Olympics and it's on mainstream TV and it's on all the time, you have to ask yourself, is that really necessary? And I agree with you. I don't think it was necessary to do that.
If anyone does feel offended by it, I would just encourage them to contact the they can email right online, send a complaint to the Standards Broadcasting, that organization. They can even write your local MP and just complain. I don't want, you know, our news to turn into Al Jazeera.
Right.
You know? And
right.
Let's have a little bit more tact and class and respect than that. It's just rude. But thanks for the time.
Well, thank you very much, Paul.
Yep.
Bye-bye now. And we're going to go to Line Run and speak to Mary in Ottawa. Good afternoon.
Hello.
Hi, Mary.
Oh, hi, Dr. Dworkin. But 3 years ago, I had this, a strain in the back of my legs, just the both of them as if you were going up and down a ladder.
Mm-hmm.
And I am diabetic, and the doctor was treating me for neuropathy.
Mm-hmm.
And she gave me different medicines to try, and nothing helped. So this year, I kind of got fed up, and that went, and I paid for an MRI in Hull.
Mm-hmm.
The results was, it says there is, however, prominence of several deep veins in each calf, which could be evidence of deep venous dilation, varicosities due to valvular insufficiency.
Valvular insufficiency, yes.
Now, what can you tell me about that? And then my foot nurse says it's claudication, and I got these expensive elastic stockings to wear, but I don't find they help.
Well, there are several things that are going on here. One is you do have diabetes, and you have had neuropathy, which means that you have already suffered damage to the arteries running into your leg.
Okay, but it showed no polyneuropathy found on EMG.
Okay, so that's that. But you do have diabetes. How long have you had diabetes?
Oh, about 12 years.
Okay. Any high blood pressure at all?
No.
Okay. Has the diabetes been well controlled over this time?
It has. Like,
okay.
I've got good control over my diabetes.
Okay.
I'm on very, very low medication.
Okay. So with regards to the MRI and the deep vein varicosities and the valvular insufficiency, what that means is that the veins themselves... Veins are designed to allow blood to flow in one direction. So every time blood flows through, when your heart beats, it pushes blood through, then it takes a rest for a fraction of a second, then it beats again. So in between those beats, the blood, if you're standing, you would expect the blood to flow backwards, right? It's being pushed up your leg, but in between those pushes, it takes a slight pause. Now, in order to prevent blood from pooling in your legs, your veins have little valves, and those valves will close every time the blood flows a little bit backwards. It literally shuts them closed like a door. But over time, what can happen is those valves can fail. And when those valves fail, the vein will start to dilate from the pressure of blood that just sort of pools in them, especially down in the lower legs. And when veins dilate, that's what's called varicose veins. And varicose veins, depending on how large they can become a painful condition. And if it's deep in the leg itself, or if it's a deep vein and the veins are dilated, there sometimes is a risk of a clot to form in them. But usually there has to be some other medical condition to stimulate that to occur. But nevertheless, with what's called venous insufficiency, it means that the veins are not able to transport blood as effectively away from the feet and the lower legs because the valves are damaged. And as a result, the feet can swell, the lower legs can swell, and that can become quite painful, especially when standing for extended times.
I don't have any of that.
Mm-hmm.
I have burning.
Right.
And, like, feels like a bit of numbness.
Well, if you have burning and numbness, that's not something the veins would usually cause, because burning and numbness would imply that the nerves themselves, which have to tell your brain that it's burning and numb, have to be registering something that is going on that does that.
Okay. So, is it the nerves you think, in the muscles doing this?
Well, usually it wouldn't be in the muscle. It would be on the skin surface if you're getting burning and numbness. And even though the EMG may not have shown very much, there are a couple of tests that can be done. And unfortunately, we're running out of time, Mary, but there are tests that can be done that in the office, one of them is using a little, it's almost like a little wire that touches the leg to see if you can feel anything versus other areas of the leg. And that tells us whether there is any neuropathy or not. But actually, unfortunately, I have to go, but I can certainly continue this conversation with you next week, Mary.
Okay, good.
All right. Okay, bye-bye now. My thanks to everyone for listening in on the rebirth of the show, episode 292. We'll be back again next week with another edition of Sunday House Call. Dr. Yoni Fridoff will be joining us to talk about nutrients and putting stuff in food, having that vitamin-enriched cola. I'm Dr. Barry Dworkin. You've been listening to Sunday House Call. Have a great week.